this theme struck me as interesting, and also I like the cover painting very much.
Isn't that incredible?
Who did
that? Pascal did that. She's a woman who's done a number of not only covers, but she's good at graphics also, and has had a couple of shows here in New York. She did the Ariel Dorfman novel, Widows, that was just out, that got a good bit of play. And she's done a new series of Virginia Woolf novels. So she's wonderful. Some people hate it, but I don't. I like it.
Well, I think the best way to start would be for me to ask you a little bit about yourself. So give me a perspective about who you are and what you are.
This is the seventh novel. One book of translations of Spanish poetry. I'm a professor at the University of Arizona in the Creative Writing Program, which is the largest in the country now, which might be of interest. I've lived in the Middle East. I've been a Fulbright professor to Peru in South America. I've taught and lived in Mexico. My goodness, originally from Alabama, did theater here in New York for a while. Café La Mama, open theater, such places. In researching novels, for one last year I went to the Turkish-Iranian-Soviet border up to Mount Ararat. I went to Sandinista in Nicaragua for this one, wandered around down there for a while. So I don't know. You could play that any way you want.
How often do you get to New York?
To New York? I guess twice a year.
How long will you be here now?
I'll be here until Thursday morning. Then I go to do a couple of residencies in Kentucky. While I'm here, I'll be reading at Princeton and at Hofstra and lunching with editors and doing that sort of thing.
Well, it looks to me, in looking over the cover blurbs and the publicity material, you've hit across a character who sounds as though he could be traipsing through Latin America today. Why don't you tell me a little bit about who this person was and why he became a nation thief?
Okay, William Walker is a fascinating man. He's almost unknown. Perhaps one person in 10,000 in this country has known his name. He was a man who was 30 years old. At 19, he had been a surgeon after having studied in Heidelberg and Edinburgh and at the Sorbonne. Never practiced. By 22, he was a lawyer. By 25, he was editing a major newspaper in New Orleans, working with a man named Walt Whitman on the paper. Took off to San Francisco. At the age of 29, led an expedition down to Lower California, took over Lower California. Didn't make much of that, headed into Sonora and had to come back. The interesting thing about him before he went to Nicaragua is that he was, in many ways, the quintessential American liberal, radical, in fact. He was something of a socialist. He was a feminist. He was an abolitionist. He was a very staunch anti-imperialist. And yet, when he was 30 years old, he took off on a contract with 57 men to Nicaragua to help the Democratic Party in its endless civil war against the conservatives there. And within a year, he was not only general-in-chief of the armies of Nicaragua, he had defeated every other army in Central America and had himself elected president of Nicaragua. His great mistake came when he nationalized Cornelius Vanderbilt's transit route through Nicaragua, because at that time, that was how you got from New York to the goldfields of California. Cornelius Vanderbilt based his fortune on that transit route. Walker nationalized it, and the people of Nicaragua decided their liberator had come at last. He had organized a people's army, as he called it, of barefoot Indians who had followed him and were going to take back Nicaragua's patrimony. Well, strangely enough, he wound up selling the transit route to a group of San Francisco investors who were friends of his at much better terms than Vanderbilt had. Vanderbilt sent down arms and advisors against Walker. Walker, besieged on all sides, decided that his only hope lay in the South, his native South. He was from Nashville originally. So he issued a decree legalizing slavery. So he had come full circle, you know, from the young American radical to a man who had found himself in a position of power, and all of his talk about democracy and progress and the sciences and liberating the oppressed in Central America had wound up in some ways, the most despicable of ends. He was eventually taken out of Nicaragua on a U.S. warship. He and his men, he made three more tries to come back to Nicaragua. And on the fourth, irony of ironies, captured by the British, turned over to the Hondurans, who shot him, executed him at the age of 36. He was a great lover of Lord Byron, I might add, and that was the age at which Byron died. That must have given him some satisfaction. Executed him and buried him in Trujillo, Honduras, which is where, at the moment, we're setting up our Operation Big Pine 2 headquarters. So, for the first time in 130 years, he's hearing American boots again over his grave, and I imagine him at night, you know, rising up and saying, "By God, you've come back, boys."
Mm-hmm. That's a nice way of putting it. How did you run across Walker?
Just surely by accident. I had been down to British Honduras and had decided that I might like to try a novel set in British Honduras, and was reading up on Central America and ran across a couple of references to him. And I said, "By God, that's the most interesting story I've ever heard. It's utterly amazing."
Did you have similar themes in previous novels, Latin American themes?
I had written, yes, one other novel that was set in Peru, but dealt not with Americans. It dealt with a Peruvian cholo from the mountains who was living in Lima and working in the thieves market there. So it was very different. But the story of Walker fascinated me because it is not only the first gringo in Central America, the first real gringo, and the first contact we had, but also because I saw a connection between American incursions although he wasn't supported by the government, he was certainly an American and had a lot of support in this country, from there all the way through Vietnam. And I think that that connection can make itself. How all of our best ideals, how all of our best notions of how other countries really ought to govern themselves have collapsed because we insist on imposing that by any means possible. More than that, I think, the Walker himself interested me, Don, because he is, in a sense, the quintessential American ironic tragic hero, if you will. And what the novel tries to do, more than anything else, is to capture the feel of that time, that period, through, I think there are 11 different narrators, overlapping dramatic monologues. I don't think of it as a documentary novel or a historical novel. The important thing to me is the literary aspect of it, of capturing that almost, as I say, perfect, ironic, tragic American hero and the voices that surrounded him that recreate that time and place. It was Eden failed, if you will, because he started out there with his men going to Eden, and the throughout not only that whole period in American history, but throughout all of his rhetoric, that paradise motif again and again and again cropped up. And the contrast between paradise and the reality of what happens when power and guns get introduced into paradise, the contradiction in that, fascinated me as novel material, so I never considered doing a nonfiction book on it.
Well, where did the fact leave off and the fiction take over?
What I try to do, I suppose, it's close to writing autobiographical fiction, in that you realize that, perhaps unfortunately for novelists, God is a historian and not a novelist, and he doesn't always arrange things the way that he should. So you try, if you possibly can, to stay as true to the spirit of the time, the details of the time. You don't have people riding in Cadillacs in 1850, for example. I tried to stay as close to the major events of Walker's campaign in Nicaragua as I possibly could, with the dates and so forth. I tried to get at Walker's character, although a lot of it is my invention. And what you do, I think, is recognize that the truth you're trying to get at is not necessarily the biographical truth of the characters, but, if possible, the truth of their role and function in the novel, if that makes any sense at all.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. Did you tell me you went to Nicaragua?
Went to Nicaragua, right.
And did you do most of your research there?
No. I had to go to the Library of Congress, the National Archives, the Tennessee State Historical Society. All of that material is there. In Nicaragua, there's very little material actually preserved about Walker himself. So what was interesting in Nicaragua and what I went for was to get a feel for the place and the people and the landscape. And that, I think, pervades the book. The book, for me, has a very large lyrical dimension, mm-hmm, of capturing what is paradise. And if I were to, in the same way, I suppose, that Walker and Walker's Men felt, if I were to say there's one spot on Earth that could be paradise, it's Central America.
Is there a place today, do you believe, in Central America for a person like Walker?
Is there a place today?
Would he fit in with today's rivalries in that part of the country and our influence there?
Well, I don't know. My friend Robert Stone says that Nicaragua was never so well governed as when Walker governed it. Is there a place for a strong man? Sure, a strong man in Central America could pull it together for a little while, although the notion of uniting it all is something that's been tried ever since independence, and it's failed. I think that the only way that Central America is really going to pull itself together is by allowing the people themselves to choose whatever kind of government that they feel is best suited to them. That, of course, is very easy to say. I don't think a man like Walker, a strong man, could survive now any longer than Walker did if he were trying to pull it together the way that Walker did, you know, by the imposition of an American system on Central America. What's going to pull Central America out? I suppose our recognizing that, as Roosevelt said, and this is a little off the subject, I realize, as Roosevelt said, Somoza may be an SOB, but he's our SOB. You know, if we could simply look at the governments that are legitimately coming into place in Central America, like the Sandinista government, and say, okay, they may be socialist, but they can be our socialist in the sense that yes, we can cooperate with them, we can offer them things on an equal basis, and not, as Walker did, try to impose on them something that ultimately benefits not them, but us, although the rhetoric tells them that they're going to benefit. Walker was believed for a while, but Nicaragua, I didn't find a school child who doesn't know the story of William Walker.
Were you influenced at all by the work of Robert Stone?
No, I don't think so, because I didn't read his book until this one, the draft of this one, was
Flag for Sunrise, I think it's called Flag for Sunrise.
A Flag for Sunrise, yeah. Right.
This has a contemporary locale.
It's got a contemporary locale, and it's also in a mythical Central American country. I like his work very much, but as I say, I don't think so.
But you say you and Stone are friends. What sort of relationship?
Well, we know one another from the Breadloaf Writers Conference.
I see.
Where we both were last summer, and we've done some correspondence.
Where does
Robert... I know. I hate to claim kin.
Where does he live?
He's in Connecticut now.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to try to get him in at some point.
I think he would be a good man.
I should have had him in when Flag for Sunrise came out. Tell me a little bit about how you approach, in general, your fiction. Obviously, you have a series of narrators in The Nation Thief. What about some of the previous works of fiction? What have you done there in terms of approach?
In terms of approach. Some of them have been rather conservative, third-person, limited approaches. What I've tried to do is realize that the world of publishing is now becoming divided, or it has been on its way to dividing itself into the world of original paperback and original hardback. Paperbacks are no longer simply reprints, as you well know, and as everyone in the world, I suppose, knows. So what I've tried to do is to alternate doing a paperback original, a book with a more mass base, and a book that is of perhaps more serious literary intent. So the approach in the books with a mass base is to concentrate on story and character, and to let the form be of secondary importance. Whereas in the two historical books that I've done, I've attempted to get as broad a sweep, to realize that if you're writing, I did a book about the last great IWW strike, the Wobbly strike in Arizona, a book called Bisbee 17, a few years ago, in which I used about five or six second and third person narrators, you know, looking through those, trying to filter events, recognizing that the old story of that each man knows a portion of the elephant is probably true. And if you're going to write about a historical event, then what you've got to do is simply assemble the parts of the elephant and let the reader put those parts together, which in one sense eliminates, I think a couple of reviewers have said that the book lacks a historical context. It eliminates the possibility of the kind of historical context that a nonfiction book would give you, but that's compensated for, I think, by, I think it was Steinbeck that said, history tells you what happened, fiction tells you how it felt. So that if that's true, what I've attempted to do is to put a reader in a time and place that has some significance for us now, for him, for the reader, for her, and let those pieces be put together as the reader wants to, which I think is what art is all about. Serious fiction is all about.
The Nation Thief obviously stands a good chance of being reviewed. I've already seen some of the reviews. But when you do the mass market paperback, that type of book is usually not reviewed. Aren't you afraid of losing some sort or segment of an audience by going the paperback route exclusively?
Well, you lose a certain segment of the audience, yes, but you gain in mass what you lose perhaps in
prestige.
Prestige.
Critical acceptance?
Critical, yes, right. I think paperbacks are being reviewed more and more often in more and more places now. The Times is still a holdout, and I don't know whether they will ever let down their walls or not, but I think it's a shame because I know a number of other writers who, like myself, consider themselves serious novelists who are publishing in paperback, and there are editors out there like Bob Wyatt at Ballantine, for example, who recognize and eagerly seek good, well-done fiction to publish in paperback original.
Walter Tepes is a case in point.
Yes.
Walter wrote The Hustler 23 years ago, and he's coming out with a sequel this fall. I can't remember the title of it. The Color of Money, I think it's called.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
It's going to be published by as a paperback by Warner, with a first printing of 500,000.
500,000. So you're going to reach 500,000 people.
Walter to still have... he'd like to have a hardcover spinoff somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Usually it's the other way around, but in his case it's not. And it's The Hustler 23 years later.
Wow.
Fast Eddie, 23 years older, and Cincinnati Fats. But it would be nice for him to have a hardcover because he'll have a better chance of being reviewed by the Times.
He will, and it's becoming more and more common for it to go from soft to hard. That used to never happen. The contract never used to be for a softback first and then a hardback. But it's happening more and more, and as I'm sure you're well aware, the European system is to publish in soft cover first and then publish in hardback.
Well, almost all of the early Vonnegut's were published in paperback before, like Mother Night, Cat's
mm-hmm.
Cradle,
mm-hmm.
are all published
mm-hmm.
as little paperbacks.
I didn't realize that.
That's true.
And some of them were.
And because of the ephemeral aspects of these paperbacks, if you try to find first editions of these books, they're very expensive because people don't take very good care of paperbacks. They're meant to be disposable.
They're meant to be disposable, yeah.
Whereas if you have a hardcover book like The Nation Thief, people take good care of it. And if they're going to shell out $13.95, it's not a bad price, but they still want to take care of it, and they'll put it on their shelf.
That's right.
And put the paperback, you know, it's passed on to the aunts and the uncles and the kids. Well, listen,
also the paper and so forth, the quality of the paperback, I think, is going to improve, and that's going to make them more keepable.
Well, as a matter of fact, there's a company in New Jersey, it's called FlexiBook, or they have a method of publishing, which is called FlexiBook. And what it is a soft cover, quality soft cover, which is built on the book itself, so that you don't have the binding that you have with a regular
mm-hmm.
hardcover.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's soft.
Mm-hmm.
But very superior. So the quality of the paper is just about the same, but the book costs about half as much as a hardcover, and
yeah.
It has the durability. Matter of fact, the cover is so good that it can be dropped in water. The pages may be damaged,
mm-hmm.
but the cover holds up nice. Water runs right off of it.
Thank God for them. You know, the Latin Americans and Europeans have been making covers like that for a long time now, and it's about to... I know that several major houses here in New York are considering doing lines of trade paperback like that, and I sure hope they do.
Robert Houston, it was nice talking to you, and I apologize for the lack of preparation for the interview, but I think you more than compensated for that and filled me in on the way you work. And what kind of schedule do you have at the University of Arizona?
You mean in terms of teaching?
Mm-hmm.
It's a relatively, as long as you keep publishing, a relatively a favorable schedule for a writer. Two once-a-week seminars, so they're only 2 days a week, and then I go out and I go down to a mountain house, a house up in an old mountain mining town named Bisbee, near Tucson, and can hide out for 4 and 5 days and play monk.
Is that where you live, Bisbee?
No, I live in Tucson, but I have an old miner's cabin, 100-year-old miner's cabin, that I've renovated there and use as a place to get away from all of the things that Tucson, qua city, seems to throw up in the way of writing, and can hide out.
So you work primarily in Bisbee?
I work primarily in Bisbee.
So you're there how long? 4 days a week in Bisbee?
4 or 5 days at a time, or during holidays, sometimes 7 and 8 days at a time, which makes my wife a little unhappy sometimes, but she
understands. Hears you pecking away at the typewriter. They can't. Does she go with you?
Or? No, she doesn't.
Oh, she doesn't
No. In fact, she says she'd much rather that I be there when I'm writing because it's...
Keep an eye on you.
Well, no, it's just that I'm a bear when I'm writing, apparently, and it's much better.
Well, you know, John Barth was telling me that he does much the same thing as you do, except he takes his wife with him, but he has a little house in, it's called Chestertown, Maryland, on the Eastern Shore, where he was born in Cambridge, Maryland, and... he teaches at Johns Hopkins.
Right.
He has two seminars. Mm-hmm. So it means 2 days of work and maybe a third day where he can do a little business. And he's got a little apartment in Baltimore. But then the other 4 days he takes off to the Eastern Shore where he keeps his boat and does his writing there. He does his writing. Actually, he has the best of all worlds. He's got all of his classes in the afternoon that he can write from 9:30 to 12:30 in the morning, even in Baltimore.
Even in Baltimore.
Yeah.
That's the hard thing to do for me because there are so many other little things that crop up, you know, reading student papers in the mornings. And if you get away and leave everything behind you, so you leave all of your other work behind you so that you know that you can't do it, you're 90 miles away from it, okay, and there's nothing around except a typewriter, a sheaf of paper, whatever research materials you need are, and one way that you keep your sanity is... by working the whole time you're there.
How big are your seminars? How many students are there?
They're not very large. The smallest, the graduate seminar, I think, is about 10 people this semester, and I have an undergraduate seminar of about 15 people.
Are they working in short stories, novels? Or?
They're working, one of them is a graduate novel seminar, so they're working almost exclusively on novels. The undergraduates are a mixed bag. Occasionally I teach a seminar in translation, too, which is fun. It's a different discipline. It's a different. It's a break in reading the kinds of fiction manuscripts that you normally get from students who are quite good these days.
John Gardner started the creative writing workshop at
Binghamton.
Binghamton. It was the first time they had one there, and he told me that most of the students that he had wound up finishing novels, and most of them had them published because it's a skill that you're not born with. You learn it. You learn the techniques. And he was very, very pleased with the quality of the students and pushed them into learning the techniques necessary to get something published.
That's predicated on the fact, and it is a fact, that John was a marvelous teacher. I've co-taught with him at Breadloaf and at other places. And he could take raw talent and give it the kind of craft and the discipline that it needed to produce something. I think that's what any teacher in a writing program has to do. You realize you can't teach talent, all right? So I think what John was saying is if the talent is there, what you can do is teach them the craft so that you have to be very careful, especially in choosing your graduate students, to try to use whatever instincts for talent that you've got and make sure that they've got that. And then you teach them the craft. You're like a coach, in a way.
But, you know, there's a collision between the academic writer, the teacher on campus who writes himself and works with students, and those who don't. For example, William Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he's just been made a tenured professor at the State University at Albany,
mm-hmm.
but he is not inherently a professor. He was a newspaper man and book reviewer and... teaching is just was a sidelight.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, he was a self-taught writer, although with a journalistic background. There is a certain smugness and superiority among, not yourself, but among certain academics about writing. Gardner did have this in his new book on his brand new book on writing, which mm-hmm. I haven't quite finished. But in this, over and over again, he goes into the benefits of being on campus to learn to write. Well, James Purdy is another person who has taught a little bit, but it's never worked out for him. And again, another self-taught writer. And I'm not sure. There does seem to be a certain amount of skill in general. Perhaps more skill among those who teach in an academic background and write at the same time. But I'm not willing to give up the others. I'm not willing to give up the James Purdy's and the William Kennedy's yet.
Writers. No, I don't think we should. I think that the major thing that a writing program can do is save you a lot of time. The old school, I did a show with Erskine Caldwell not long ago, who was very, very adamant about not going to a writing program. He had no idea what went on in a writing program. He got it all wrong. He was of that old school who put his typewriter in and a suit and a bag and got a garret in New York and sat down and read and learned to write that way. You can do that, but it takes 10 years, say, through trial and error, to learn those things about the craft that you can learn in, say, 2 to 3 years in a Master of Fine Arts program in a good university writing program. So what you're doing is simply saving yourself 6 or 7 years of that kind of trial and error, in which time I would hope you might be able to turn out a couple of good novels, so that you're using that allotted time mm-hmm. that you have between maturity and dying more fruitfully, I think. And that's the great value of writing programs.
I'm going to let you go because I know you have to head out to the island, and we've been talking about 40 minutes now. So
have we now?
Yes, it has. So thank you very much for coming in. It was a pleasure meeting you, and I wish you the best with the book, and I hope you enjoy your stay here on the East.
Oh, I'm loving it. I've got in-laws also. Okay, thank you, Don.